Okay.
So, good morning. The title of my talk today is Building Bridges Across the Judiciary, Child Welfare, and Child Mental Health, the Miami Child Wellbeing Court Model Project. This dissemination project represents an exciting step in the evolution of a systems change innovation that originated in the Dependency Division of the 11th Judicial Circuit in Miami-Dade, Florida. The model was born by a judge, the Honorable Cindy Lederman, who decided she wanted to foster change for the children and families that she was seeing revolve through her court in an intergenerational cycle of abuse and neglect. This judge took the unusual step of deeply educating herself about the needs of very young children, reaching out to clinical experts in infant mental health and child development to create a new way of doing business for child maltreatment cases in this Miami-Dade court. So, this is a translation research study where we're focused on developing dissemination strategies for successful adoption. We are heavily focused on producing and refining an implementation manual. We are also developing observational tools to capture the behavior change that are going to need to happen in the court by all the actors in the court. And by that, I mean the judge, the caseworker or foster care worker, the attorney, the parent's attorney, and then the child's attorney, and the infant mental health clinician. I'll talk more about who that is in a moment. We're also engaged in developing and piloting behavioral trainings, mock courts, if you will, at our participating sites. I'm leading the research team for the project in which we're assessing the extent to which implementation takes place at the sites. And we're collecting child well-being data also. But a big caveat here, we are only looking at outcomes as they are associated to extent of implementation. So this is a translation research grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's funded through the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. It's a similar level of funding as yours, $1.3 million over 3 years, very generous funding. I really encourage folks, if you haven't or are not familiar with these translation research grants, there are 18s, go take a look at the website. Very exciting work going on across a variety of different public health areas, including child maltreatment. I want to point out I have a host of colleagues who unfortunately couldn't be with me today because we're doing a training in Detroit tomorrow. Lynn Katz is, there are two arms to the project. I'm the director of research. Lynn is the director of training. She is the director of the Early Intervention Center, the Linda Ray Early Intervention Center at the University of Miami. She's affiliated with the Department of Psychology and Pediatrics. The Honorable Cindy Lederman, who had been the administrative judge in the Dependency Division of the 11th Judicial Circuit until recently, has been on the bench for more than 30 years. My close colleague at RTI, Cecilia Casanueva, our Detroit collaborators at the Merrill Palmer Skillman Institute at Wayne State University, Director of Infant Mental Health Training, Dr. Ann Stacks, Dr. Kate Rosenblum, who's at University of Michigan, a developmental and clinical psychologist. We're working in Tallahassee with a team at the Center for Prevention and Early Intervention Policy at Florida State University, Mimi Graham, Ann Hogan, and Celeste Putnam. Dean Fixon, who some of you may be familiar with that name, directs the National Implementation Research Network. He's now at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's a collaborator of ours. And Dr. Joy Osofsky, who many probably know, is at LSU Health Sciences Center, who was the originating clinical partner with Judge Lederman for this pioneering effort. Okay, I want to just give a brief overview of some statistics about maltreated children at the national level. 33% of kids with substantiated maltreatment are really young. They're under 4 years of age. These children are entering foster care at two times the rate of older children. Children under 4 years of age are predominantly experiencing neglect, and make no mistake about it, neglect is as deleterious for child outcomes as the more active forms of abuse, like physical abuse. 38.3% of victims have been maltreated by their mothers acting alone. And again, keep it in context, we're talking a lot about neglect, but this is happening in about 40% of the cases under the care of the mother. 18% are experiencing maltreatment from both parents. I just want to give you a very quick taste of what's happening in Michigan and Detroit. You can see that, not surprisingly, Detroit, and we're working in central Detroit, inner city Detroit, the rates per month of child abuse and neglect cases per 1,000 children, most recent data here is 13.9 per 1,000 in Detroit. And if you take into account where the density of child abuse neglect cases are happening, the rates actually are higher at 18.7 to 25.2 per 1,000 children. You know, Florida, it's been a little harder to get county-level data. We're working in Tallahassee there, so we're talking about a very different demographic, obviously. The child victim rate in Florida is a startling 32.1 cases per 1,000 children. That's actually more than two times the national rate. It's right up there with the five biggest states, and it tops the child maltreatment rates of the five biggest states in the U.S. Child maltreatment victims in Florida, about 13% are less than a year old. About 21% of child maltreatment victims are less than 5 years. In Leon County, where we're working with a judge, 24.9 cases per 1,000 children of child abuse and neglect. I want to bring this up. So I think for many people who aren't aware of the child welfare system and how it works, people don't realize that in 88.7, nearly 90% of cases, children who were being investigated for maltreatment are staying at home with the caregiver. And remember that about 30% of those children are at risk of being with a caregiver who perpetrated the neglect or abuse. Then there are 30% of children who are removed from the home and enter foster care. And those kids end up being reunified with the caregiver. So the point I want to make here is that the biological caregiver is very much in the picture, whether the child is in the home or out of the home. So let me talk for a moment about maltreatment. I have a feeling there's some people in the room who know a lot clinically about maltreatment and its effects on the young child. And I can't really do justice to it here, but let me emphasize a few key points. Erratic, rejecting, hostile, abusive, or neglectful parenting leaves the child feeling helpless, leaves the child abandoned in the face of unpredictable, uncontrollable danger. And so this type of traumatic exposure is really difficult for the child on multiple levels. It's very much in contrast to traumatic experiences that happened once. The unpredictable and chronic nature of maltreatment is particularly problematic. And what happens is, this type of parenting is absolutely contraindicated for what a child comes into the world wanting to receive developmentally, and so it disrupts the development of secure attachment, which, as psychologists in the room will know, it predicts a host of secure attachment, predicts a host of good outcomes, insecure attachment, the opposite. This whole phenomenon then leads to child traumatic stress and the result of the child's ability to process things normatively. So they lose the capacity for self-regulating, to know how to respond in stressful, mildly stressful even situations, like negotiating the demands of the school setting, for example. And I like to show these visuals of a normal depiction of neurons with many connections. So this profusion of synapses, everybody's sort of familiar now with early brain development. This is what it looks like normatively. And this is what happens when a child is exposed to the chronic stress of maltreatment. There are far fewer neurons, you can see in the visual and the photograph. So not surprisingly, you see that children who have been investigated for maltreatment, and the data here I'm citing, if anyone's interested, is the National Survey of Child and Adolescent Well-Being, commonly known in the field as NSCAW. And RTI, where I work, we collect the data. It's longitudinal data on kids who come in contact with CPS across the country. It's really interesting data because it looks not only at children who have substantiated maltreatment, but children whose cases are closed. And it follows up to see outcomes of both those cohorts of kids. So what do we see in the NSCA data about what's happening with these kids? Well, not surprisingly, 41% of toddlers, 68% of preschoolers are showing evidence of emotional and behavioral problems. Remarkably, with all these risks, all these problems, 75% are not even receiving timely mental health intervention within 12 months of being reported for child abuse or neglect. Not surprisingly, of the children who enter the system as infants, 30% are showing behavioral problems at school entry. That's looking ominous. Okay, so what's happening in the court? Status quo in the court right now. More than 800,000 families receive child welfare services annually. About half of those receive either voluntary or court-mandated referrals to parents, often parenting skills training. Okay. Success, measured by completion of certificate of attendance. Okay? Cases are frequently dismissed even if that certificate doesn't come into the courtroom. less than 2% of these parent training programs are evidence-based. And when I say evidence-based, I'm referring to, for example, the California Clearinghouse for evidence-based programs relevant for child welfare. SAMHSA has its own registry of evidence-based programs. I'm sure folks are familiar. And ranging from, you know, the most rigorous research to randomized controlled trials to somewhat less rigorous research, maybe quasi-experimental. Less than 2%, though, are representing evidence-based interventions. And the services are not targeted. You will have parents. Remember the two types of situations. You'll have parents who are there who don't have their child with them. And so obviously that's probably, well, depending on which state, but it's probably because that case was more severe, okay? And then you have parents who have their children still with them who are being investigated for maltreatment. So you have a mismatch there, an inappropriate collection of participants in these interventions. What is the Miami Child Wellbeing Model trying to do? Well, our story is, and this is how we obtain CDC funding. You know, usually you would go to OJJDP for money for court intervention work. We went to CDC to say, hey, look, the court is a platform for increasing the reach and effectiveness of evidence-based program. It can be a platform. It is not presently in most situations to improve the well-being of children. At the heart of the model is in Miami-Dade is child-parent psychotherapy. So this is an evidence-based practice. There have been two randomized controlled trials using child-parent psychotherapy developed by Alicia Lieberman and her colleague Patricia Van Horn at University of California, San Francisco. The intervention modalities are uniquely appropriate for a very high-risk, vulnerable family. They bring the mother and very young child together, and it's sort of a bifurcated intervention process where you're dealing with the mother's ghosts in the nursery, what she's bringing from unhealed emotional wounds from her own childhood experience of poor parenting, what she's bringing to that caregiving relationship. It's a heavy focus and it's developmentally driven to provide unstructured, reflective guidance to the mother about what the child's developmental needs are. It's a lot about speaking for the baby, interpreting to link the past with the future. Hey, mom, your baby's telling you, your baby is saying, pick me up, comfort me. Why do you think that you're not able to see that when your baby's calling to you? Concrete assistance, case management, and crisis intervention are parts of this model, but there's a very strong emphasis on not letting that outweigh, although in practice it's hard, the therapeutic modalities here. Oh dear. Okay, so the model in action. What's happening that's different? In traditional court, the judge is an umpire. He's calling or she's calling balls and strikes. The case is put before her or him, and he adjudicates. In the Miami Child Wellbeing Court model, the judge is actually educated about child development and then actively engages all parties so that they're there in the best interest of the child with the lens of developmental needs of the child in their focus. In traditional court, the judge is assuming that the service that he or she is referring the parent to are going to make a difference. For the Miami Child Wellbeing Court model, judges need to be aware that they need to ask, tell me about the service you're referring this family to. I want to see evidence that it is evidence-based, that it may have an effect for this family. The clinician, in usual cases, a clinician may be called for testimony. In this model, the clinician is an integral part of the team is actually a liaison among the caseworkers, the caseworker, the attorneys, and speaks in the court for the baby to the judge. The judge calls on the clinician, not as an expert witness, but as part of the court team, as judges in normative practice would call on an attorney. Okay, so here's my nice visual. I play the violin. I like to always make reference to classical music, but it's the judge, instead of being an umpire, conducting a court team, that they're there together to provide the most informative information to the judge to make effective judicial permanency decisions. Now, I'm running out of time. We drew heavily on the implementation science framework provided in this piece, which if people don't know about, it's just an enormously useful guide for implementation research. We have kept in mind from the National Implementation Research Network's sort of concepts, core concepts for implementation work, that it's going to take a long time. Folks, it just takes a long time. And when I get to strategies, I can't say this enough. It doesn't happen overnight, and everybody at the table, all stakeholders, need to recognize it could take as many as 4 years to get to the point where you're actually implementing what you hope to implement. So at our disseminating sites, they've been very anxious to move fast, and that's just not possible. This is a very densely loaded slide, but the point is that the National Implementation Research Network also talks about implementation drivers. One of the most critical drivers is leadership, and I want to emphasize what adaptive leadership is. It's being able to facilitate a stakeholder committee. It's not just having the technical knowledge of how child welfare works, the court system works. It's being able to take people at the table who may have conflicting interests or turf issues and bring them together. We are very focused on building community capacity. There are four pieces to that that are critical. Selecting the implementation team, and by that I mean the committee of stakeholders who represent decision makers in the community, who are going to be committed for the long haul to seeing this implementation, this innovation to reach implementation. Training is important, and we're, as I mentioned, we're working on effective trainings. But what's more important, we've learned, is intensive TA or coaching, and by that I mean one-to-one conversations with the people at the dissemination sites and the folks down in Miami who we are referring to as sort of the expert court team, the clinician in Miami on the phone with the clinician in Detroit, the caseworker in Miami on the phone with the caseworker in Detroit. We're talking very frequently. It can't just be a biannual training. And finally, one other thing about this visual is that court and clinical observation tools are so important. It's not enough just to ask people to fill out a paper pencil, what are you doing, self-assess yourself. There has to be an observation in the court, and I don't have time today to do justice to the clinical issues at play, but we were also developing an observation tool for the adaptation of CPP, child parent psychotherapy, for court-mandated treatment. So I'm just going to go right to barriers. We really were surprised at how there were already folks at both sites. Tallahassee had kind of this child mental health initiative. Detroit has been working on its baby court initiative for years. There's a very committed judge in Detroit. Nonetheless, there were a lot of turf issues at play in those stakeholder groups and power struggles. We also, and this is a real problem for the field, there's going to be a change in leadership at the judicial level. Judges come in and out, and they're elected into office to some states. Sometimes their tenure's only 2 years. We encountered a change in judicial leadership in Tallahassee, so we had to work with a brand new judge. And the biggest barrier, I would say, has been haste makes waste, a rush to action before all the players really understood what they were getting into, and then a lot of confusion along the way. Strategies. I would emphasize that it's important, particularly with a very complex innovation like this. This is a systems change innovation. This isn't just taking, okay, child parent psychotherapy and moving it into a community mental health center. This is about changing a variety of systems, behaviors, communications, fostering collaboration in a new way. It just takes time. It's important to make sure that the stakeholders who are part of your implementation team know what they're getting into, understand what they're getting into, and if they have issues, that those get put on the table and an effective leader, preferably the judge, preferably multiple leaders though, can hash through those before going forward. Leadership, leadership, leadership. Judge Lederman in Miami-Dade would say it all starts with the judge. Well, she's not here, so I can say, yes, it does, but it also, you can't rely on that because judges of quite varying perspectives, you know, I talked to some judges down in Miami and they said, you know, I have a JD. I don't know a thing about child development. Tell me, teach me. You're going to have some judges who are not going to want you to tell them or teach them. Part of the potential effectiveness of this model is helping the judges to learn to listen to clinical partners. And that can take time for them to open their ears and be receptive, but that's another modality for effecting change. And then I would just say that there's been a lot of hang up about the money. And I think research in the room may be familiar. You know, we had a research grant and the site said, where are our dollars? And we said, well, we can't fund clinical work with this. This is a research grant to look at how to effectively train you so you can adopt the model and for us to assess implementation. And there was a lot of hanging up around, we don't have any money. It's taken a year, but we've gotten to the point where there's been some reflection, self-reflection at the sites, and they say, you know what, wait a minute, we're spending a lot of time thinking about the 5% we don't have. Let's think about the 95% of resources we do have. For example, one lead director of a child welfare case management agency in Tallahassee reflected, hey, you know what, caseworkers are going to court. They're going to court repeatedly. They're spending time in court. They're getting paid to spend time in court, but the judge never asked them any questions. So he had a sort of aha moment and thought, all right, this is about learning new ways of operating in the existing infrastructure to a certain extent. So I would just say that in the end, just to quote Cindy Lederman, she looks at the court, the dependency court, as a venue, a platform for engaging in healing, therapeutic jurisprudence. It's a model that's used in drug courts and mental health courts. And what she's trying to do in Miami is a child well-being court. For those of you who know child welfare, we look at placement or permanency. We look at permanency, stability, and we look at child well-being. Those are the chief indicators of success for child welfare agencies. And guess what, folks? Nobody's really thinking about child well-being. So this is an effort to really bring our focus to a hard place, which is how do you affect change at that depth of level, right? It's not just about making sure placements are stable. It's not just about time to permanency and making sure that happens expediently. It's about along the way attending to the needs of the young child. Boy, all of us talk so fast. My apologies.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, so these are implementation grants. There are four of them funded under this round, and the goal for all the projects is once the three-year demonstration time is up to post our materials on the national website so that other, not just Head Start, but it open to whoever wants to do it. So eventually, yes.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I'm Betsy Miller. I'm a child care health consultant from Philadelphia. I have two questions. One for you, where do we get the book of what do you do when your child gets sick?
They advertise it on the Office for Head Start website, and if you email me, I can also give you a direct link. I should have brought that information and I didn't.
Okay, and then my other question is for you, for the Melvin and infants. Are you doing any kind of research or following up with the infants when they're in child care and the number of children that get kicked out of child care because of their...
This particular research project, we are not. And I would say more on the implementation side, there's a concern about ensuring that these kids, the kind of collateral services that these children are getting, also meet some kind of quality standards. As you know, most of these kids are getting pretty sub-quality child care experiences, and in fact, that's where they're spending a lot of time. So no, we don't have a research component built in yet, but the point is well taken.
Thank you.
I think you've been trying to ask a question. You want to, yes, stand up and could you project to the back of the room too?
I have a question for, I think it's Aaron and Christina about the Early Childhood Center. And I'm curious about your high definition of high and low support.
So for that graph that I did, we just looked at the family support scale and the number of supports that the family ranked or perceived that they had. And on that, I was just using the highest support group versus the lowest division by
half. Self-reported?
Yes, self-reported by the caregiver, primary caregiver.
Yes. And then you first. Yes, please.
Hi, Marcy Spalding, nurse and health manager in San Francisco Head Start. But I had a question about the Head Start program. How did you define the medical home in terms of determining whether or not a parent, a family had medical home? I know it's a difficult concept to grasp.
It is, and this is a given a definition of a medical home using the qualities of medical home. Does your child have access to this, yes or no? And we have a number of questions that wrap into all of the different subcomponent scales. So the next set of analyses we're doing, we're looking at what scales actually lead them to say they have, you know, what characteristics of medical home lead them to say they have one. That graph that I showed you looks identical to them, not totally identical, but pretty close to them saying they have a usual source of care in primary care. So we think it's probably they're identifying primary care pediatricians' offices as their medical home. So really looking at what we're really interested in looking at is the qualities around medical home that's leading them to say that.
Sure. My name is Susan Barkath. I do work with teaching English to adults and incorporating health literacy in those programs. And I was something that I think that we run into a lot when we're trying to do health interventions, health education interventions in education settings is there's an assumption that the teachers in whatever those settings may be they Head Start teachers, be they adult literacy teachers, that they come with a baseline knowledge that is ahead of the students that they're serving. And in my own experience, I've seen that that's often not the case, that there's a lot of health literacy research out there that would support that. And I was wondering if in any of the sort of research that you've done with your the trainers that have been trained, if you have been looking at sort of any kind of gains in knowledge among that particular group, any sort of shifts in their own use of the healthcare system and their own knowledge related to the different content areas that you're covering?
That is a super interesting question. We are not, but anecdotally, I would think you're spot on. We've seen a wide range. And so, you know, we very sort of naively, I think, thought about family health workers, that they would be trained in kind of this content area and would be the ideal people to do it. But what we found, some are great, some are very uncomfortable doing sort of a parent education. They much would prefer doing the one-on-one education as opposed to a group thing. We've had some teachers want to step up and do parent, and they do great with parent meetings. So Head Start does normally parent meetings. Then we give them a curriculum and training in an area, and all of a sudden it's like too overwhelming almost. And so I think there's a whole lot about the train-the-trainer model that is ripe for just a whole bunch of different studies. Their ability to feel comfortable delivering the material, how effective they are. We do fidelity checks, so we go and observe all the trainings, and they can be all over the place. So, but I think the idea about healthcare literacy, so anecdotally we'll see it really related to the area of medical home. So those that kind of understand the system and how it works do a much better job of implementing that component of the intervention than those that I think that are struggling and learning it on their own as they're trying to present it. That'd be a great study, I think, to look at that.
Yes.
Angie Blossom from the CDC. I just wanted to comment on the importance of having this kind of support system, because from a public health perspective, there is a single intervention that's often used when the children are infected or maltreated, which is to remove the child from the home. And people don't see this, but it is an intervention, and it's often much more traumatizing than the events leading up to it, because the children are typically put in places with strangers that do not know how to care for them, and then they move multiple times and eventually possibly return. So you have, for particularly for young children, you have multiple separation traumas added to the initial injury. So in order to prevent the crime of maltreatment, children actually, well-being may actually be harmed. So that's another added incentive of why this has to happen, because we are doing something that may not be helpful, but could be harmful. So maybe it's in addition to saying, well, we're not doing intervention, we are doing intervention, but we need to do a different type of intervention to make sure the children's well-being, which is actually the reason for these laws, is actually being paid attention to. So.
Comments? Yes,
right there. Hi, Kim Sidnor, Larry's a mental science faculty at Morgan State. I had a question, but I'm doing mental health court evaluations now in Maryland, so one of the major issues we struggle with is treatment availability. So you have this court model where you're telling people what the perfect picture is, and you know all the issues that are attendant to families. What is the court doing about its capacity to access services since it's not funding the project?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say that the RA team that we responded to needed to be focused on a particular evidence-based practice. And the child-parent psychotherapy that I referred to that I refer to is what's in place in Miami-Dade. It's taken a long time to get that into place. And very recently, they've been able to advocate to their state Medicaid agency to get reimbursement for CPP, child parent psychotherapy, for 25 sessions of it. But it's taken a long road to hoe. I would say that it's a two-pronged process. We're working in states that already had, purposefully, that already had strong infant mental health services capacity. But your point's extremely well taken. And in my bio, we made mention to the organization 0-3. I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but one of their big missions is to build the infant mental health services workforce because it's a very limited capacity. Your point's well taken. I would say beyond this grant, more broadly, the model is, can the judge be educated about what an evidence-based service is? That the partners, the community partners, tell the judge, well, judge, this is what's available, this is what we wish was available, and the judge takes an active role in saying, I want this in my court. The judge has a lot of power. So if the judge is saying, I'm not referring to you unless you have an evidence-based practice, it can be mobilizing for provider organizations. That's not to say it's easy or solves the problem of funding, but it's one important advocate's voice for building capacity at the sites. So it's not only about CPP, but evidence-based services in general.
Other questions? Okay, please join me. Thank you.